Hi, I'm J. Christian Adams, president of the Public Interest Legal Foundation. This is the Protecting Your Vote podcast. The Public Interest Legal Foundation is a nonprofit charitable law firm that litigates for election integrity all over the United States. We brought cases in faraway places like Alaska, Hawaii, Maine, Florida, South Carolina, Texas, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and every place in between. And we bring cases to defend the right to vote, to defend transparency, and most of all, enforce election integrity. Clean elections helps bring consent of the governed and gets everybody on board to having a better system. And one of the reasons that we have a better system is because we're protecting the right to vote. Public Interest Legal Foundation is representing voters near Philadelphia who received death threats in the mail if they were going to vote for President Trump. One of the worst things you can do in a Western society is threaten people for political involvement. That's something that other countries and other times have seen, but we shouldn't ever see in America. Death threats should not be part of a presidential campaign. But sadly, in 2024, they were. And that's why the Public Interest Legal Foundation has brought a case in federal court to protect the rights of those who receive these death threats against, we don't know yet who, they're John Doe defendants. And the court, the federal court, has granted us leave, meaning permission, to do discovery to find out who these individuals were. There's actually a $2,000 reward at the Public Interest Legal Foundation website, publicinterestlegal.org, for any information leading to the identity of the individuals who sent death threats to people who put Trump signs in their yard in Pennsylvania in 2024. With me today, joining us in Protecting Your Vote podcast, is one of the attorneys working on this case and one of the attorneys new to PILF. And I can't say how glad we are to have him, because with new attorneys, we have new ability to protect the right to vote and ensure election integrity. With me today is Jule Lightfoot. Jule, welcome aboard.
Good to be here.
You're kind of new.
1 week so far.
First podcast, right? Protecting Your Vote podcast.
First podcast ever.
Well, it's not so tough. We'll get through this one. So, Jule, you are now working on the Philadelphia case. And had you ever thought prior to this that you would learn about death threats to voters as a kind of newfangled behavior, or was it something you thought was totally possible?
I did not think that we'd be in a situation where voters would be getting death threats in the mail. It's obviously something that happens with the rhetoric escalating, but it's not really a case that I thought we'd be working with, and it's definitely one that requires Postal Service assistance.
So, your background, Jule, you came to PILF from the Department of Justice, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, DOJ lawyer. I was too, so it's always... I always like a meeting, well, I should say always like meeting DOJ lawyers. That would be a bit of a stretch, wouldn't it? Like, there are some you don't really...
Like meeting the ex-DOJ lawyers.
Right. So what division were you in at DOJ?
So I worked in the civil division at the Department of Justice, specifically in the environmental court section.
And so the civil division is the part of DOJ that is dedicated to litigation, right? Like, usually defense, I think, but not always. Is that generally what civil does?
It's basically everything that's not criminal. And so civil division, a lot of what you do is defense. Everything I did was defense because we're in the environmental tort section. But when you have the sections like the federal court section, they actually do civil litigation as a plaintiff, which is why they were the division responsible for suing sanctuary cities to try and make them comply with federal standards.
I see. Now, there's also the civil rights division where I was in at the voting section in the civil rights division. There's a few other divisions like ENRD and National Security Division, Antitrust Division, which would be, I can't even imagine working there. I mean, you spend all day with numbers. And Tax Division, which is possibly even worse to work in than the Antitrust Division.
Well, you have the special assistant U.S. attorneys for all those that are delegated out to the different U.S. attorneys' offices that take on functions as well.
Right. Now, one of the things I like about having experience at DOJ, and maybe this was your experience, maybe it wasn't, is you kind of get really good at writing briefs and litigating. I mean, I did, at least. I don't know if that was your experience, too.
Absolutely. We were very overworked, but it was a chance to work with some really talented attorneys. And so you got a whole lot of input from very experienced attorneys, and it absolutely makes you a much better lawyer going through there.
Yeah, I agree. Now, a little bit more background in a minute, but what is it that kind of made you want to be a lawyer? Were you on a lawyer track?
I absolutely was not. This is my second career. So I went to the Naval Academy, and my first career plan was to be a career naval officer. And I didn't really have a backup career plan to that one. And I remember while I was at the academy, we had a professor, her name was Priscilla Zotti. Her husband was a Marine Corps colonel, but she was an attorney. She got her PhD from Baylor. And she taught a constitutional law class there. And the basis of her doing was just that we all took an oath to defend the Constitution. So it's best if we know what we took an oath to. But it was, I mean, really a rewarding class. It was easily my favorite class that I took there. It included a trip down to the Supreme Court. We got to meet with Justice Sotomayor. And it was the first time that I actually did legal briefs or had to memorize legal cases. And I really enjoyed it. And so going on that class, I figured if I ever leave the military, I guess plan B would be to become a lawyer.
Interesting.
And once I decided I was leaving the military, I said, okay, well, plan B is be a lawyer. So that was the direction I went in.
So I want to talk more about the Naval Academy in a second, but so this was something that while you were in the Navy or in taking classes popped into your head. It wasn't like sort of like when you were 5 years old and you wanted to be a lawyer.
No, it was not. In fact, since every individual in the military has to get a master's degree, and I had no idea what law school actually entailed. I figured it'd be like a master's degree. Whenever I was going to my first assignment, I actually was thinking, okay, well, what if I did law school at UW, because I was going to be assigned to Whidbey Island. And the only reason I didn't try it was because the commute was too long, which is actually a benefit because law school is nothing like a master's degree. I would not have been able to swing that on a deployment tour.
Right. So let's talk about military voting. Did you ever serve at sea during an election?
So I did. I served at sea. I served at sea 2015, 2016, so not during an election. I've been in the military during elections, but I didn't have to vote at sea.
Right. Do you know about designated election assistance officers, like the people who are supposed to be helping?
So you have those on land, too. You get emails from them saying, like, hey, go ahead and vote. I was registered to vote in Washington State because that was the state that I was assigned to. And so they helped me transfer my voter registration to Washington State. But I was able to just sort of do a mail-in ballot and vote.
And was it harder as a member of the military? Or what is your experience with that?
I don't recall any difficulty voting as a military member versus being a civilian. It was very streamlined and easy to do out of Washington State. Whenever I was working in Washington, D.C., I was still a resident of Washington State because you get to retain your previous residency. So even then, I had mail-in ballots for Washington State while I lived in D.C. and Virginia.
I see. So, you know, I got to tell you, with some recent experience with admissions policies, the Naval Academy, I think, is the hardest school to get into in the United States now. Like, it's got like a 4% admission rate. I think MIT is second, like at 5%. Holy moly, that must have been something to learn you were going to the Naval Academy.
It was. So they always had a saying that one out of every 10 fully qualified applicants gets in. So I think at some point, once you're in that 10, they just pick one. And I was, I think, very fortunate to have the opportunity to have gone there.
What ships were you on? I'm curious.
So I deployed off of the Harry S. Truman, but I was part of the Air Wing. So I was in VAQ 140. So we were based out at Whidbey Island, Washington, and then we had to fly down to Norfolk for actual deployment. I've been on board the Nimitz briefly, and I've been on board the GW briefly.
I saw the Truman come back home to Norfolk one weekend during COVID, and it was being painted by somebody hanging over the side, believe it or not. Like, that was their job, to repaint the Truman.
Yeah, that's going to be a bosun's mate. Anytime your recruiter tells you to just go undesignated, don't listen to them. It's not that great of an opportunity. Definitely get a contract when you go in so you don't have to be doing the chipping paint job.
Right. So Philadelphia. Philadelphia, again, is a case where Trump voters are getting death threats in the mail. We allege in our federal complaint there's a violation of the Voting Rights Act. You can't send death threats to people in the mail threatening them because they want to vote for Donald Trump. What is your sense of how the bureaucracy is inclined to respond to things like this? Does the bureaucracy leap to the game and go after the perpetrators, or is the bureaucracy, in your experience, kind of slow and plotting, or somewhere in between?
My experience at this one, doesn't appear like they've been leaping to go after the perpetrators or even made the first steps towards going after the perpetrators. We've been getting a lot of unnecessary pushback from the Postal Inspection Service just to get the basic information related to an investigation, which either means it's A, ongoing, or B, they haven't done
it in the first place.
Exactly.
Yeah. And early in this case, folks, we got a response from the Pennsylvania State Police and two local police departments in Pennsylvania saying that they didn't even open an investigation. I mean, look, there were death threats, threats to come in the middle of the night to attack your family on the cold, dead winter's night was the language used, shoot the family cat. These were real, genuine threats. And for some reason, the Pennsylvania State Police and the other police agencies didn't even open an investigation.
Well, I'd say it's even worse when it comes to the postal inspection, because they were the ones that delivered the letter. Like, they were an integral part in delivering death threats to people's homes, and there seems to be a lack of interest in actually looking into what was going on there.
And, you know, some people might wonder, what can the Postal Service do to figure out who sent the letters? Okay, well, some of you might remember the anthrax scare back in 2001, I think, now, and anthrax is being sent in the mail. And you can learn a lot of information if you're the postal inspectors. You can figure out what zip code those letters are mailed from. You might even be able to know what box they were mailed from based on the code, the pickup codes. You can do DNA testing on the envelope saliva or the DNA testing on the envelope itself. And you can look for fingerprints on the envelope. You can look at who the stamp was. You can look at all sorts of data points. And it appears that the Pennsylvania State Police and the local police didn't even open an investigative file. I mean, it's an amazing dereliction of duty. I said at one point that it's like they have Inspector Clouseau working for them and there's a monkey. And I know some of you will get that joke. The Postal Inspection Service, wouldn't you think that they would have the most laboratory resources available to them to figure out where a letter was mailed from or who sent it?
Well, this doesn't even require the most laboratory resources. They're able to figure out, they scan the letters before they send them from one post office to another. This is a very basic look, just to zero it down. If they wanted to go into, you know, forensic resources to try and figure out who specifically it is, I would assume they have that capability, but at the very least, we should be able to know which post office it was mailed.
And these days, so many people have cameras, whether it's the post office itself or Ring cameras on your door. And don't forget, these voters who got this mailing had Trump signs in their yard, which means the perpetrator had to case the house, right? They didn't just look up on Google who has Trump signs. They had to drive to these people's homes. These neighborhoods are going to be filled with Ring cameras or other cameras that are out there. It appears that nobody's even asked for these camera addresses or footage.
Well, it's not even cameras from one neighborhood. There's cameras throughout the entire state for people who receive these. So there actually is an investigation beyond just a one crazy neighbor sending out letters. So it would make sense that there actually would be a statewide investigation into who's sending out threatening letters to intimidate voters.
Governor Josh Shapiro, governor of Pennsylvania, had his house, they don't call it the governor's mansion, they call it something else. He had his house firebombed about a month ago. And talked about political violence, how horrible political violence is, threats of violence. We had a terrible incident recently in Minnesota where a state representative was gunned down and killed. Political violence, and we all abhor it. It's a terrible thing. Why is this political violence like second rate? Like, why hasn't the governor of Pennsylvania, why hasn't the New York Times, why hasn't CNN, why haven't any of these alleged guardians of peaceable political discourse chimed in here? Now, I know you don't know the answer to that.
Well, I don't think anyone has. They've never given an explanation. It's just a lack of interest. It's the same thing we're seeing from the Postal Inspection Service. They haven't provided an explanation for why they don't have the details. They just have not responded to our emails beyond the form letter we received.
Right. This is Protecting Your Vote podcast along with Jewel Lightfoot, and we're talking about the threats of political violence in Pennsylvania against Trump voters. the Public Interest Legal Foundation has filed a lawsuit to get to the bottom of who sent these threats. Apparently, the Pennsylvania State Police, they've said they don't have an active investigation. They've done nothing. The local police departments have done nothing. But I want to discuss kind of political violence in the course of history. I mean, our country has not been free from political violence, but it's something that most Americans overwhelmingly find repugnant, and most Americans would be in favor of getting to the bottom of, and most Americans don't want to see in our elections. So I think from an institutional perspective from PILF, we just have to see this case through. We just have to run it to ground and get to the bottom as far as we can go. But at some point, institutions need to step up, don't they?
Well, we have institutions that are supposed to be doing this already. So if PILF's efforts can motivate these institutions into either doing their job or to admitting that they had no interest in doing their job, that's at least a first step. We lack the capacity to actually enforce the law because we pay people to enforce the law. The taxpayers in Pennsylvania pay people. The federal tax dollars pay people to enforce the law. And that necessitates that those people, once the law is broken, actually make steps to enforce it, not selectively, but every time it's broken.
Folks, imagine if you got a letter at home, no matter your political persuasion, saying that if you vote a certain way, you might get shot. That's what we're dealing with in Pennsylvania. That's what we're dealing with in Philadelphia. That's why we're fighting in federal court to enforce the Voting Rights Act. You can't intimidate people with threats of gunshots if they support a particular political candidate. I'm all with Jewel Lightfoot. Jewel, welcome to Public Interest Legal Foundation. We look forward to really unleashing you and getting a lot of election law experience. And I hope you're in for the fight.
I'm absolutely in for the fight. This is going to be fantastic.
Great. I'm J. Christian Adams. If you'd like more information about the Philadelphia voter intimidation lawsuit, it's in federal court right now to protect the people who were going to vote for Donald Trump. You can go to our website, publicinterestlegal.org, for more information. Until next time, thank you for listening to the Protecting Your Vote podcast.